the Eric Anders Lang Show. We're back, and right now we're in the clubhouse of Rivermont Golf Club. Rivermont Golf Club, but there's another C on the end of it I saw from outside. Rivermont Golf, I saw two C's, RGCC.
It used to be Rivermont Golf and Country Club.
Oh, I see.
Now Chris has changed it. We sold the pool and tennis, and so it's just a golf club.
So now it's just Rivermont Golf Club, which is RGC, which is something I believe in, called the Random Golf Club, which I think you're a part of now. Mark Hoban, you are the superintendent of Rivermont Golf Club. I could go into a lot more detail to define you, but I feel like that's what we're here for, to talk together. How do you see being a superintendent?
Well, it's the greatest job in the world because it's my office is always outdoors, and I love the outdoors, even though if it's raining or cold, I still would prefer that than an indoor office space. So I look at it that way. I get in very early, get to see the sunrise and the beauty of the day starting every day. Don't have to work at night, so I appreciate the elements.
And you basically... We'll get into a lot of the intricacies of how you do your job and how you make it, you know, a craft and how it's so unique. I guess the overall theme for that would be sustainable golf course agriculture.
Right, just low inputs and kind of on that less usage of pesticides and inorganics and more environmental friendly type slant to my management style.
Right. There's so many interesting things I want to dig into this. When we played the course this morning, we talked a lot about all the facets of this. So we'll get into that. I'm kind of curious to know, Dave told me about, you know, Dave is the friend of the pod. Dave Marcuscilli was on the podcast a while back when we were right at Waste Management. We met because he's based in Arizona. What do you call yourself, Dave?
Design coordinator
for Nicholas Design Group. And so anyway, he said he found you on TurfNet, and I was curious to know how the internet has maybe helped innovate, the work that you do on the grass and the dirt that we play golf on.
Wow. I guess TurfNet and Randy Wilson has just brought to light some of the things that I'm doing innovatively or in conjunction with what I've learned at other places. But I don't sense that there's a lot of people beating down my door to say, hey, can you teach me? Can I learn from you some of these things? We're product-driven on the quality of our turf is very demanding, and imperfections are frowned upon, and so the pressure is on us as a turf grass provider of fine turfs to almost perfection. You know, they see perfection on TV each week on the tour, and, our membership is not that forgiving as far as what they expect after they get inundated week after week with perfection. And I don't know where I'm going with this.
Well, to chime in, I mean, that's not just your membership. That's the millions of golfers around the world, you know? And as well, your proximity to Augusta National, we're about 2.5 hours. We're just north of Atlanta.
Right.
We're in Alpharetta, right? Is that true? Or Roswell?
We're in Johns Creek. Used to be part of Alpharetta, but you're right. It's that Randy coined it, the Augusta syndrome. They watch that. They see the azaleas. Why can't we have azaleas on our course? Why are our fairways not green when theirs are? It really is a real reality.
And the simple answer is what?
Having a strong leadership like our owner Chris Cupid, who has a vision and is willing to stand behind our program of going a different route and using less inputs and looking to have a healthier soil to suppress diseases and pests. And we're being successful at it, and it's something that I feel our members are being educated on and are starting to realize how much of an advantage they have here, not just a good playing conditions, but they have the wildlife and the native grasses and the different visual aesthetics month after month instead of the typical Atlantic course. It's green the summer, brown in the winter. We have a lot of things going on month to month, so it's an exciting thing, and we've involved our members in some of our programs with bird counts and monitoring birdhouses and things like that. So it's added value to the membership.
So to go back to the beginning, when did you arrive here at Rivermont?
I came here, was hired in the 2005.
Okay. So this is your 14-year project.
Right, right.
Because when you got here, it was standard. Were you guys overseeding?
No, we were not overseeding, except for the club grounds and the practice tee. Everything else was just Bermuda went dormant in the winter and had the brown look, and we had bent grass greens that were old and inundated with poa.
But you didn't have what you call natural grasses and what I would call tall grass that sits next to the creeks on the property.
Correct. And, yeah, we were groomed wall to wall. We used pesticides wall to wall. We mowed wall to wall. So they watered wall to wall. A lot of inputs. And we changed all that in the years to follow. Chris had played the golf course that I was at previous and saw some of the innovative native grass things that I brought in there, and he felt comfortable with me starting that program here, and it's just snowballed into how far can we go.
To give you an idea, if you're listening, you know, and I know I try to really keep this podcast open source for all levels of golf knowledge and make sure that we're all on the same page. What we're talking about is, it's the example I'm going to bring up is visually, when you go to Augusta or when you see it on television, right, 12 is a great example. So that short grass there on the front face of that little par 3 just goes right to the water. But when you go into the media center or when you Google old images of Augusta, you notice that, I mean, there's tall grass all over the place, like tall grass. Like I'm talking 3 feet of grass, the same kind that you see in Scotland when you play or Ireland. Or Bandon Dunes, and that's fescue, or what you call it, broom's hedge here.
Correct. We have a combination of those two.
So, you know, what you get is a much more natural-looking course, probably more in the vein of this Core Crenshaw movement, right? When Mike Riley, built the course in 72, something like that?
No, it was a Joe Lee original, yeah, 1972, 73. So Joe Lee... It was the original designer.
Right.
And then in 2005, 2006, we had a redesign by Mike Riley.
I see. Okay. But either way, they were just looking at the bones of the course, and you came in and added this, I'm going to use probably the incorrect term, but it has a rustic feel.
Right. I call it, yeah, we did the natural framing of the golf course, and that enhancement brought in all the wildlife and the pollinators and just added a more contrasting visual to the product out there, the golf course.
And, you know, what you get, if you're listening and you're trying to visualize what I'm talking about, what you end up getting is actually a much richer visual experience on the course. You feel more like you're going for a walk in nature rather than stepping onto hallowed grounds, which I prefer. But the interesting thing that I found out after playing for a few hours and then talking to you again was that there was a fascinating byproduct that may, for you, have actually been the initial reason to make this change, the filtering of the water. You're saying,
right? You know, golf courses are looked at in a negative manner from the general public, but really, we use very low inputs, and we have a great product. Turf binds up and holds nutrients and chemicals, and doesn't allow them to leach into waterways. But we enhance that by letting our natural grasses grow up around our waterways, so we have this really heavy buffer. And it entraps particles and contaminants and doesn't allow it to drop into the waterway. We're the last drop off before this water goes directly into the Chattahoochee. So the water coming into our sites has a lot of runoff from streets, and some of the condos have oil and contaminants in it, and we pick it up. But it's filtered through our property, and when it goes off the property, it's a cleaner product than when it entered.
And now, is this a so what you're kind of saying is that this golf course is benefiting perhaps not just the immediate community, but maybe anyone down the river?
Yeah, downstream is benefiting, of course, from it, and that's a big deal. The waters, the Chattahoochee that it dumps into is, you know, there's a battle between us and Alabama and Florida for who has the rights to this water. And again, the further you go downstream, if you get into south of Atlanta, that water is same water we had left our property is really has a lot of negative contaminants from the city of Atlanta.
Interesting. Now, is this a cost-effective switch or is it more expensive?
I think it's cost effective. We found our first year we dropped our fertilizer inputs in half on...
Those are expensive.
Oh, yeah. Fertilizer is quite expensive.
What is the most expensive commodity that you have to purchase year in?
I think it's fungicides for the...
Fungicides.
Yeah, fungicides. And you're only talking about roughly 3 acres, your greens. That's the only area you're really treating.
Trying to remove fungus from the greens that comes from where?
Well, it's airborne. It's in your soils. It's always there. And these pathogens, you know, love the Georgia climate, this hot humidity in summers, that kind of thing. And when your plant's under stress from heavy play, heavy traffic, we've had a monsoon-type rains for a good year and a half. We're 30 inches above normal last year. We started this year the same way. So you put your plant under more stress, but we've come to realize that by having a strong, healthy soil, that we are able to suppress diseases better than we were in the past using a lot of fungicides and inorganics. So I can't quantify, but we just know we're saving money in our inputs and still providing a good product.
Now, so is the fungicide, is that sort of the same math problem, or is that the same reality as like when I heard of a course becoming abandoned and then someone said that they were mushrooms growing on the greens? Is that what you're fighting?
Yeah, well, that's fairy ring, and that will grow. It's golf courses are susceptible to it, and you know, some golf courses treat for it, others don't. It's not an all-encompassing damaging disease, but the quality level demanded for our greens is close to perfection, and any blemish is considered, you know, a negative. So that's why the emphasis on the dollars and what we're doing is focus on the greens management.
So the owner, Mr. Cupid, what is the pitch like when you well, I have allergies. That's for real.
Yeah.
We're here a couple days before the Masters. Thank you so much for having us out and for being a member of the podcast.
Well, you picked a great day. 70 degrees in early April is awesome.
Remember, though, when I arrived here at 7, it was 37 degrees.
I did point out the frost in the rough. Yes.
That was impressive. It was such a beautiful morning. And if you're listening to the pod and you don't typically go on the YouTube channel, please do. That's going to be live at the same time as this. It's a wonderful, you know, educational experience. I'm really grateful that you have done the work that you've done so that, because I'm fascinated by it. I think it's just so interesting, you know. So when you come in here and talk to Mr. Cupid about his property, for which he really, let's talk for a second about not just sustainable environmentally, sustainable financially. The members are here at Rivermont. You know, we don't need to get into the financial details, but it's a very reasonable monthly fee. I'm told that he doesn't make any assessments for improvements to the property, which is incredible.
Right. For a single owner, and he's making these improvements every year out of his own pocket, which is also incredible. So he's quite unique that way, and his support for our program is 100%. That's why a lot of golf courses can't do that, because the demand for perfection's there, and if why would a superintendent risk losing his job of maybe going this direction and it not working as well immediately? That's the whole issue. It is a slow go. It's not a light switch. Oh, I'm going to go less inputs and you're there. No, it's you have to bring your soil health up in stages so that you get there where you're suppressing diseases. And it's not magic, and it's not a cure-all. I do have to spray pesticides. I do have to spray fungicides, but again, we've reduced them by 50-75%. And I feel like I'm on the right track, but research is so far behind, so we haven't learned what is more conducive to soil diseases and what's less conducive. So it's kind of a game that we're mulling our way through and pioneering our way through to come up with these answers.
You know, I mean, I kind of wanted to get to this a little later, but why? Why do all that?
Well, you know, the easy answer is it's better for the environment. I'm having a ball doing it, and I feel like it's a challenge that is a good challenge, and it's the future of our industry. It really is, to utilize what we have. I'm seeing it in other countries. Sweden cannot use pesticides on their greens. Other countries are limited.
It's illegal in Sweden?
Illegal. Correct. So they're having, now granted, they don't have the pressure on diseases that that we do in the Atlanta environment. But
why?
Well, you know, humidity, heat, rain, you know,
Scotland probably doesn't even need pesticides.
Well, they do. And they're struggling, but they are having to learn answers faster than we are. But in the United States, there's restrictions on fertilizer usage, phosphorus, for instance, nitrogen limits. So it is coming to America. It's just slower coming, and I'd rather be ahead of the curveball and figure it out as best I can, rather than wait till the government says I must.
You're kind of in the turf care world. You're the equivalent of sort of playing from the tips or playing blades. You're sort of choosing the harder option.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
I'll have to remember that, playing with blades. Yeah, that defines it well.
Well, you know, I mean, you're looking at your vocation, and you're asking to be challenged further, which is clearly a mark of someone who loves their job.
It is. I admit that openly. I'm passionate about it, and you know what greater job can you have to love what you do, and you can't wait to do more and learn more. I mean, it's really an education, and that's why we do a lot of research here in-house, because there's so many answers that we don't have.
I'm curious to know how you found this job.
I was at the Stainer Club for 30 years.
I mean, prior, like, how did you come into golf originally? Like, how did you find yourself?
That's funny. I was looking for a summer job. My dad says, why don't you work on a golf course? I didn't even know the job existed, so I wrote to four different clubs: Peachtree, Atlanta Country Club, Stainer Club, and Capital City, and the Stander Club answered my letter and hired me on at 15 years old, and I fell in love. I said, this is what I want to do the rest of my life. This is the greatest.
What year was that, and what was your position?
1971, and I was just a summer worker and a junior in high school, and I came back and worked, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas and holidays, and went to ABAC and got my two-year degree. My boss had graduated from there and went on to the University of Georgia and hired me on as an assistant. And he left to become the director of education at the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America. He was president of the association while I was there, so I had a lot of time that I was the boss. And so they hired me on as the superintendent at 21 years old. And the interesting thing is we had Bermuda greens, and that year they hired me in May. In August, I sprayed Roundup on them and converted the greens to bent grass. And then 35 years...
When you say you sprayed Roundup, that sounds innocuous because I don't understand what you're saying. You're saying you murdered the Bermuda.
Murdered the Bermuda to convert it to bent grass.
You just went in and killed it.
Yeah, at 21 years old, all the greens, killed them all, converted to bent grass. We had done a practice green the year before, and then 35 years later, here I am on bent grass, and I sprayed it with Roundup to kill it, to convert to Ultra Dwarf Bermuda.
You've come full circle.
Full circle, and brother, it's great being back.
You're young again. You're young
yes, again. Yes, but the Ultra Dwarfs have made me young again.
So I was going to make a pun. I don't want to get into the weeds, but I am curious to know the difference between bent and Bermuda. And just, I guess, you know, the reality is down here, I guess I want to try to see if I know the answer. But, you know, in Georgia specifically, bent is popular because it lives. It lives throughout the hot summer and the cold winter.
No, you got that opposite. It's a bear during the summer. It is very difficult to keep it alive.
Bent is the one with all the fans.
Right. The parent plants came out of Northern Europe and go 12 inches tall, and we're trying to cut it below an eighth of an inch in the hot, humid South, and it is very, very difficult task. You're an artist, and you're living on the edge because of all the pressure of what you do to that plant. But it has the shade tolerance, and it outperformed the Bermuda grasses at the time back in the 70s and early 80s.
So what do the pro golfers prefer to putt on?
Well, they've been saying bent grass, but you know, at the Tour Championship at Eastlake last year, I heard players and commentators saying it's the best greens they putted on tour all year, and those were Ultra Dwarf Bermuda grass greens. So I think Ultra Dwarf is starting to fit in, but you know, it's kind of like the golfers prefer the bent grass because they grew up with it and they think there's some mystique about it, but you know, you look at how a ball rolls, and if it doesn't waver side to side at the end of the roll and it's consistent, you can keep a firm surface year-round. And that's the thing for us in Atlanta, that Bermuda can be a more consistent speed day-to-day throughout the year, whereas bent grass has it's cyclical. When you're in the heat of summer, it's very difficult to keep those speeds up because your roots have shrunk up to a half an inch or something. So you're babying them through, you're watering them, you're not cutting them, you're doing everything you can just to make it through the dog days of summer.
What is the grass that breaks uphill? Is that Bermuda or is that bent?
You know, supposedly it's Bermuda, and it's got that notoriety about it, the grain.
Yeah.
But these Ultra Dwarfs have very little of that. I think the golfers have heard that word grain, and then it's ingrained in their head that it breaks uphill, it breaks to the water, it breaks to the mountain, that kind of thing. But we've got some great cultural tools to keep that plant growing upright. So it's more of a perception than a reality.
Well, is it with Bermuda that as you get into the summer, you can't cut it as low, and so the grain
just the opposite. You know, these guys, my counterparts, I mean, they're cutting at 70 thousandths of an inch in the summer. I mean, they're in the dirt, and they can get those greens rolling at 14 if they want. And they've got clubs that outcompete each other to who has the fastest greens.
Really?
And the memberships want that. And it, you know, you're four-jacking it all day. Who can have fun like that? But they're used to it, and that's what some of these guys are able to produce.
So, in the role of the super, do you feel that they should discourage green speeds above what number?
I'm thinking for average play, you know, the 10 to 11 and a half is a good range. It's not scary fast. You can drop some long putts because the ball rolls true, but you start getting faster and faster, and play slows down. And that, I think, is a negative on our sport, time to play the game.
I would agree, and I've heard a lot of other experts say the same thing. When golf started, greens ran at like a 7.
Exactly. The Masters, yeah, a 7.
What does Augusta run at now? They won't tell anybody, but I've seen them run a stimp.
Yeah, my guess is 10.5 to 11 because they have so much undulation that they, you know, they would be putting it off like the sixth green if they got them any faster, you know.
Right. Sixth green, good shout out. Not the most famous hole there. That's the par 3?
Par 3, yeah.
That's not the, you know, the hole doesn't get a lot of love. He's calling out obscure Augusta holes.
Well, it's nice that you recall which one it was.
It's a big green, yeah. I'm curious to know. I wanted to ask you about the green speed, and then I wanted to know. I feel like there's probably some people listening who don't know how the stimp number is achieved. I'm curious if you could, I mean, I know, but I'd kind of like to hear you explain this.
Sure, it's just a 3-foot stick with a groove, and the ball is you raise the stick to a level, and then gravity takes over and rolls it down the stick. And it rolls across a flat area, and you measure that, and then you roll it back, and you take the average between the two. And that's all it is.
So it's feet. It's 11 feet.
11 feet, right. Yeah. And that's considered, you know, fast or very fast for average play.
Right. You know, let's take a quick break. We'll go to a little break, everybody. Take your seats. All right, Precision Pro, everybody. Precision Pro Golf makes amazing golf rangefinders that are the perfect combination of price and performance. Listen, whenever I see someone on the range or wherever I go, if I see someone with a Precision Pro rangefinder, I see a paisano, a countryman, someone who's not interested in basically overpaying for a product. Same way I feel about Vice balls, you know? It's just like we cut out the middleman, we make a great product, and we get it out to you so that you can basically afford it. I mean, I don't know. I would rather have something that's good value, right? Right now, the NX7 Pro is on sale. Whoa, $40 off. Go get it. $40 off, that's a good deal. What's even better is that you can get an additional $10 off for being a listener of the podcast when you use the promo code ERIC at checkout. That's $50 off. I mean, jeez, I'm going to go get some. I've said that already. Over 800 verified reviews from real golfers can't be wrong. Here's what Ty had to say about his NX7 Pro rangefinder. He goes, while waiting on the tee box in my last round, there was a hawk flying overhead. The NX7 Pro is so fast and accurate that I was able to measure the distance to the hawk while it was moving. 178.4 yards, if you're curious. So that's about that's an easy 6, hard 7. If the NX7 Pro Golf Rangefinder can measure a hawk, it can definitely measure a flag. That's been my experience. Also Ty's experience. Go to precisionprogolf.com and use coupon code ERIC, ERIK, to get $50 off the NX7 Pro Rangefinder today. Swing with confidence, hit more greens with Precision Pro Golf. All right, one more read, folks. Adidas. Over 5 million pieces of plastic are floating in our oceans, which over time get broken down, making it easy for sea life to ingest, ultimately affecting our own food chain. So it is your problem. It's not just a world problem. It's you. It affects you. Adidas is working with Parley to prevent plastic entering our oceans and transform it into high-performance sportswear. Shoes is coming soon. Just hold on. Hold your hats, folks. I'm not even done with the ad. Stop trying to figure out what I'm going to say. Adidas is spinning the problem into what? A solution. The thread into a thread. I don't know what that means. It's written here. It says the thread into a thread. I don't know who wrote this. Adidas Golf is bringing eco-innovation to the golf course in the form of a special edition shoe. All right, this is legit, actually. This is the first time the Parley shoe has been a golf shoe. I've had it in form of a running shoe. I mean, look, it's a sick shoe that serves a purpose, okay? That's where you get it. The Tour 360 XT Parley, the first ever golf shoe. Oh, look, they already wrote it for me. The first ever golf shoe made from recycled. Oh, no, it's not called recycled. It's called upcycled. I don't know what that is. I feel like I should probably Google that. Upcycled plastic waste that was intercepted like Jason Bourne from the beaches and coastal communities before reaching the ocean. Dang, I didn't realize this is Jason Bourne's golf shoe. Intercepted. I mean, I'm a golf guy, but I also love football. Who doesn't love a classic interception, especially when it's Jason Bourne saving planet Earth? Entire upper of the shoe is made with threads spun. It's also a DJ. Amazing. From the upcycled plastic waste.
My phone's ringing. It's Andrew Marler. Hang on. All right. Well, that was a 20-minute phone call, but you have no idea. It just went by like that. Anyway, the Tour 360 XT Parlay, the first ever golf shoe made from upcycled plastic. I already read this because it's got the intercepted line. Intercepted from beaches and coastal communities in a world before reaching the ocean. The entire upper of the shoe is made from thread spun from upcycled plastic waste. Built as the Tour 360 XT, you still get great traction and stability. I feel like, what's that line from Taken? I have a certain set of skills. They will take you. Available starting June 10th at adidas.com, and for those headed to the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach, a select number of pairs will be sold on site. Get into it, folks. All right, back to the show.
You know, one of my favorite things about spending time with you and a lot of supers around the golfing world is your friend Berkeley.
Yeah, my best friend. I mean, you know, he's with me 24/7, so you don't see the wife and kids that often, you know.
I'm going to say Berkeley is a 75-pound German Shepherd.
85-pound.
85.
85, and he's 4 years old, and the most docile shepherd. I call him the ambassador. He always wants to jump off my golf cart and say hello to everybody, and the members to a fault love him. And you know, usually you'll have members that are afraid of dogs, especially big dogs, but he's the hero around here.
Is there a purpose for the so-called turf dog, a super's dog on a golf
course? Well, of course, you know, I've trained him where he goes after all the geese. And we have a blue heron.
Because the geese problem is?
It's just, you know, all the crap, and they like to do that around the green, so they make quite a mess. And same thing with the blue heron, and it's toxic and kills grass. So just by keeping them off of these areas, I love the beauty of a goose, but what they do for the golf course is horrible. So we encourage them to find bigger ponds.
So I have so many interesting facets that I really want to get into about what you've done at Rivermont. The first one I guess we'll start with is you kind of briefly mentioned the birds and getting the membership involved. And so, you know, from what you told me earlier, I guess, you know, I don't even know where to start with this. I mean, the original impetus was that you wanted birds, or you felt like you needed birds?
Right. Bluebirds at the time were, you know, in decline, and I really liked that bird. And so we just started building bluebird boxes. You know, from my early days, you know, the Cub Scouts would build them and stick them on the property, and that's where I learned about them. And then I just brought it over here. But the mistake I made, I had bentgrass greens, and we had 28 bluebird boxes, and you need to monitor them weekly. And it became overwhelming because I was so inundated with managing the greens, dragging hoses, keeping them alive through the death days of summer that they had to take a back seat. So I finally came up with, I need to get the membership involved. And so we did to a fault, and now they own that birdhouse. And I hear about it if their birdhouse door is not fixed properly or something like that to, whoa, baby. So it's great that they own them, and they check on them, and they let me know how many eggs and how many have fledged and what type of birds. There's titmice, and there's the black-capped chickadees, and obviously the bluebird. So it's kind of a fun project, and it just brings more value to our members and membership that we're doing these things and they can see them. And it's neat for the ladies to show a guest, hey, look, you can see a brand new bird that just hatched and it doesn't even have feathers on it yet. And it's kind of a neat extra.
That's merely, it's a non-essential decision that increases the experience of, you know, being where you should be on a golf course, which is in nature.
Right. And there, you know, there's so many naysayers, and I like to just have people come out here and just look at what we're doing, take a look, see all the wildlife. You know, again, my dog speaks to it too. If it's such an unhealthy environment, how do we have this just pup that just loves life and running around and see all this wildlife and see all these birds fledging? We had this woman that wrote a book on pollinator bees. She came out here and looked at our wildflower plots, and that's in conjunction with Syngenta. They have what they call Operation Pollinator, and she visited and she said, in a urban environment, she's never counted so many different types of pollinators from different types of bees. There's 700 different pollinator bees in Georgia, butterflies, moths, birds, hummingbirds, and she had never seen that in a urban environment. And in her first instincts of a golf course was, well, we'll look at some flowers, but you know, we're not going to see much else. So, and she wrote the book, and she included us in that book with those words. So, again, it's just come and see rather than, hey, I'll tell you we're doing good for the environment. Just come and see and make up your own mind is kind of my view.
So what have your conversations been like with the owner over the past 14 years? I mean, I'm sure it hasn't been easy, all of these decisions and then implementing them over time. But where are you guys at now? I mean, from what I was told, he said to you, do whatever you want. It's not about the members per se. It's about doing what I believe and what you believe is important for not just the golf course, but the community.
Yeah, but I'd say with a caveat that he is demanding that I have high quality turf. And there's been times where, like, the fairways, I was finding I was going lower and lower inputs. I cut my inputs as far as fertility by 75%. And it was like, well, how low can I go? It's almost a game. Maybe I don't need any inputs. And with all the traffic, they were wearing out. And he came to me and said, Mark, we got to do something. We got to get some green color and vigor into this turf. And so we throttled back a little bit. So he has a threshold that I've pushed maybe a little bit too far. But all in all, he stuck with me, and I've had the backing. And that's what the superintendent needs. He doesn't need, yeah, it's fine. If there's a little stress, let's dial it back. He's hung in there on the hard days. So, but the good news is it hasn't been that many hard days. It's all been relatively easy, I say, but again, I'm going full bore on research and trying and implementing things to do better each year.
Because you could easily just have a truck show up with a bunch of chemicals and you could turn this place into Augusta in a year.
If you had that much money, yeah. It would maybe be more than a year, but you could do quite a bit. Right now we've got enough money to maybe get the first hole looking like Augusta. And then we'd run out.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, this course is an outlier in many ways, right? I haven't heard of a course that's this visually stunning, number one. Congratulations. Good job.
Thank you.
That's this architecturally interesting, right? I mean, I'm seeing green structures, really, really wonderful green to tee experiences. So I get off the green, I walk right to the tee. It's right there. It tips out to 71-60. Which is a great number, right? It's not 77.
Right.
It's not 69, right? It's a good number. I played two 500-yard par fours on the front nine, and I loved it. I mean, I love having a 4-iron into a par four, you know?
Yeah.
Then I love having a sort of a half a wedge. It's a varied, you know, bones that you have to work with. And then as well, you know, you've been given this creative opportunity within your own job that we've been explaining, but as well you have this really sustainable financial situation for the membership to join into a situation where kids can join here. 18 years old, you can join. You know, you can afford to play golf in a private atmosphere. And not that the private atmosphere is the value, but I think what you get at a private course is someone like you. You get to learn a little bit more, and you get to become part of a community. And it's not so much, obviously, if you're listening to this, you know that I'm, you know, private clubs, there's a whole set of issues there that I struggle with being in America, and I just wish I lived in Scotland every day of my life. But
how about Ireland?
Ireland,
I'm
too.
I'm partial there.
Is that family for you?
It is, and when I went there and saw what they were doing, like right off the tee, the high grasses, and I'm going, why am I cutting around these tees? And so we went from 2.5 days of cutting rough to backing off even around the tees and letting the grasses grow up, and it's just, it's so powerful. And, you know, why? It's not in play for a golfer, so, yeah, we keep tweaking every year. And
where's your favorite spot on this golf course? Do you have one? Do you have one spot where you go and you're just like, I feel calm? I feel like I did this right.
Yeah, I think it's number 12 because of all the harvesting of our Andropogon virginicus, which is the broom sedge seed.
Just off the tee there?
Off the tee, and it was just a wall-to-wall Bermuda, and we took out a lot of trees and added these visual framing grasses. It's just right out from my shop, so I get a lot of good pictures there, and I do a lot of my organic plot research on that hole, so that area, and then we've got the wildflower plots right across from it.
You know, one of the other interesting things about Rivermont is that I didn't realize that it was the first of its kind as far as northern Atlanta suburb real estate development. Golf course serves as an amenity to the home buyers. The first
right,
of its kind.
Right. Yeah, we've invited the public over a number of occasions to do a walkabout. We have a field day every 2 or 3 years. We're having one July 23rd, and we invite the neighborhoods and neighbors and all the turf community and researchers, and because we do a lot of research here, and just kind of spread the word and share what we're doing and with them. And it's been a real grand thing.
I guess what I was getting at, though, is this idea that now my brother lives right around the corner, and he belonged to Country Club of the South, relatively mediocre golf course, totally painted, totally fertilized, totally boring, right? Can't I mean, I think you're smiling. I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty harsh with that. I don't care, though. That doesn't mean I can't have fun. That doesn't mean I don't enjoy it. But if you want to talk about that side of it, there's nothing interesting to say. But, you know, I mean, whatever. I mean, I'm sure you have a lot of friends there. That's not either here nor there.
Well, it's just a typical country club with, you know, wall-to-wall tree-lined and home-lined houses. It was a real estate venture.
Right, and that's an example of, I would imagine, of the 20 to 30 courses in this area that are all the same. They're all just sort of, here's a course, let's build some houses on it. And this was the beginning of that, right? Because when we first started talking, I was like, I thought most of the courses in this area were built in the 80s. That was like the boom. Am I right?
Yeah, it was. It was. Yes, especially in this corridor. But I think they all would argue that they're unique in their styles. You know, I'm not going to get into that design area, but I just when we say unique, we are very unique in all those facets, from aesthetics to design to the grasses we use. And I'm hoping that, and we're starting to see some of the upper end clubs are starting to look, why are we maintaining these ridiculous acres at this high level of cost? And it has nothing to do with the playability.
Do you have anyone you look to for inspiration historically in the game of golf? I have a guess.
Go ahead, you guess.
Well, you're an Atlanta guy.
Yeah.
It's got to be Bob Jones.
Well, sure. But, you know, I didn't know the man. I love his game and some of the sayings that he's had. But sure. Yeah, Bobby Jones for sure. But he hadn't been my inspiration for what I'm doing out here. And that I don't, you know, I really will have to think about that one. I don't know where that's coming from. Just.
Well, maybe it'll circle back to it. You know, I mean, I feel like a lot of times when I get interviewed, they say, who's your inspiration? Who's your mentor? And it's very hard to answer that, because I think the truth is it's that's like getting served a meal and being, what's your favorite ingredient?
Yeah. I mean, I'll steal ideas from any and everybody if I think it's going to work or I think it's applicable to us here. So. Yeah.
What would you say overall your experience here has taught you?
It's taught me that we can use a lot less inputs and still provide a high quality playing surface. It's taught me that there's more to the game than just the fine cut of grass and 100% pure purity, that you don't have the blemishes can go along with it, and you still can provide just fabulous conditions and enjoyment. And we just have pushed it to bring in so much more with the native grasses and the wildlife and other amenities that are part of our golfing environment here.
You, you know, I sometimes ask people to, you're a golfer. You play a lot of golf. When did you start playing golf?
Oh, I used to play with my dad, you know, as a boy, just go out on weekend and hack it around and just, and then when I first found out there was such a job as golf course maintenance and was hired at the Standard Club, I played all the time when I could.
Did you ever get involved in competitions or clubs or anything like that?
Oh, there was the Atlanta Juniors. I played that, and you know, I was just so. I did work for a living and enjoyed the maintenance end as much as I did the golf end. So I never worked on the game like you need to be that grand a player.
The game that really fascinated you was the grass.
Yes. And my boss, you know, Palmer Maples, I mean, when I first, he was a researcher, and so he would set out plots of ryegrass to figure out which ryes were the best overseeded, and so he would give me the charts, and we would rate them. And so those kind of things struck with me. We would have the university researchers come to our golf course and lay out different herbicides that were not on the market yet to try to eliminate this or that weed. And so I guess that stuck with me, and now I'm parlaying it into the other end of the industry, trying to use less inputs and the organic, and what can we do that's environmental friendly and provide the same quality.
Well, clearly this is moving in the direction of the future of the game, and I was pleased to hear you offer the idea of continuing this conversation, not only just on this podcast, but if you're listening, you know, Mark is, you know, open to having this discussion, it sounds like, from what you said, with anybody who's, you know, like, curious about learning. I find a lot of the times, you know, a lot of people are curious about, you know, wanting to leave their day job and work in golf. And, you know, I feel tremendously lucky that I basically fell into this like I was reading a putt and then fell into a bunker. I don't know how it happened.
Yeah.
And so it's hard for me to describe to somebody else how to do that. But I do know that, you know, there are a lot of opportunities out there. And, you know, I just think that if you're listening to this and you're interested, you know, I think that there's always an interesting angle to come into the game of golf. What would you say overall golf has taught you, Mark?
Taught me patience, that nothing happens instantly, so it's taught me that. It's taught me so much more to appreciate everybody that I work with and the environment I'm in. I love it more each day, and I'm feel so blessed to be able to share it with my family and be very proud of what we've been able to produce and out here, and just can't wait to show it to people. I just love it.
If you're listening, you probably don't know because you can't see anything, but as Mark answered that question, your eyes were closed for the most part, which typically means you're really involved in the feeling of what you're saying, I've found. Sometimes I ask people to write a letter to golf. Would you mind starting off a letter that goes something like, "Dear Golf"?
Man, you like putting people on the spot. All right, I'll give it a shot. Dear Golf, if you want to see the beauty of God's work in nature, come visit Rivermont Golf Club and get an experience that's more than just hitting your next shot. You will appreciate how much more there is to offer, and it'll give you a new perspective on the game.
That was good. You shook your head like you didn't, like you weren't proud of that. That was good work.
I'm a tough self-critic.
You were on the spot. Well, that's the mark of a good creative.
Okay.
You need to hate everything you've ever done.
I'll take that.
I can't watch my own videos. I have a hard time. I really can't. I don't like it. We get a video, and I'm like, oh, God, I can't watch it.
Yeah, yeah, I know what you're saying.
But I really just want to reflect on, you know, just something I feel like I need to say is, you know, as we played out here, I played with Dave. You know, Dave came into my life through the podcast, I don't know why I do the podcast. I really don't. I mean, sure, we can, you know, it's sustainable but it's interesting to me, you know, and when I reflect back on, you know, why we got started with it, you know, and you know, the interesting turning point for me was in a way today was seeing just how, I think Dave and I were talking on one of the tee boxes there, and it was like, you know, golf is not, if golf to you is about your own swing, it's almost like, get ready to hate it eventually.
Yeah.
Get ready to be dissatisfied, because that's like going to church for the cookies.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You can't sustain a lifetime if you don't see the incredible fabric that makes up the game.
Well put.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I didn't write that. No, I mean, I didn't write that earlier, but I'm just riffing. I'm just really inspired. I really, because, you know, people who, like you, you know, being around that kind of energy and enthusiasm and curiosity is tremendously valuable. And so I'm just really, like, just so happy to have spent some time with you today. And again, you know, check out the video online if you
want
to see more. Well, you'll see it, of course. But there's thousands of people listening.
Yeah, gotcha.
Basically, say hi to my mom and dad.
Yeah.
They're only an hour away from here. But yeah, and I really appreciate the time.
And tell your brother to come over here.
He should.
And look me up.
He will.
Okay.
Yeah. Mark Hoban, everybody. Hoban. Right. Mark, you're going to get flooded with about 5 emails.
Well, I hope they do, and I hope they come out to the field day on July 23rd. I'd love to have them. I'll talk about what I'm doing anytime, anywhere. I love it, so I'd be more than happy to share it.
Well, I'll talk about it too, and I look forward to coming back, and I look forward to you know, seeing how this has an impact on all of the other golf courses in the world that, you know, may be struggling to find a solution that works better for them. I think the most interesting part of it is that the solutions that you've created are human solutions. They're not golf centric. They don't, you know, they're not just GM centric. They're not, you know, owner centric. They're community driven. And that to me is unfortunately goes against the grain, of the stereotypical golf world. And so would love to see this happen in mass and to be understood by the community that surrounds the golf courses that, you know, that golf is a welcoming game.
Right. We do have a good story to tell, and not just here, everywhere. You know, we're very well educated. We're using less inputs. We're all doing a good environmental stewardship, and now I'm just kind of going in a direction that's taken us further slanted, so to speak.
Great. Well, as your is that unsweet tea or sweet tea? Unsweet tea has arrived in a large glass. I think we're going to close out the podcast, and I really appreciate your time and.
Well, I thank you for yours and your enthusiasm. At first, I thought, you know, he's just kind of putting me on. Wow, this is this. But I believe you now. You're very candid.
When did you think I was putting you on? At the beginning of the podcast or earlier today?
Earlier today. You know, you were so enthusiastic. I was like, most people aren't that enthusiastic. But I truly have come around to really, you know, believing that, you know, and I do, that you're sincere and what you saw is made an impression on you. So I thank you for your time.
I appreciate it. Well, you know, just as a side note on that, I mean, I know that you didn't perceive my enthusiasm as sarcasm, but I can see what you might think. I mean, I typically I'm actually 16.
We both are.
Yeah, there you go. And but you know, I've actually tried to remove as much sarcasm from my life as possible. And with that, I think it is born a bit more, you know, just kind of people would call it what's the word they call it? What's the word they call it when people are serious? When they're kind of sappy.
I don't know, but you're making me think. I need to take back the bad hair comment I made to you, especially when my hair looks worse than yours.
We kind of have similar hair, though. I can see that. It's kind of similar.
Yeah.
It's okay. It didn't hurt my feelings. I could tell it was this compliment. I could tell.
Okay.
No, the word is, I can't remember the word. It starts with an R, I think. Anyone know the word I'm thinking of? It starts with an R.
That seriousness? Respective? Respect?
We're really closing out this pod with a bang.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, everybody. If you're still listening, I'll send you $5 on Venmo.
Yeah.
It's like when you're really serious. It's like people say, oh, your Instagram captions are so blank.
Real.
No, not real. It's like an insult, kind of. It's like,
righteous?
What?
Righteous?
No, righteous. No, no, no. It's like, and maybe it doesn't start with an R. I'm gonna be very. I'm very rarely this. It's like one syllable. Anyone got it? It's. I'm gonna pause.
You can pipe it in.
I'm gonna pause it and find it. Hang on.
What is it?
All right, I got it. It doesn't start with an R, but it kind of does. Earnest. Anyway, strive for earnesty. That's a shitty ending to the pod. Sorry, everybody. Mark, have a good life. I'll see you in a couple months, probably. Okay. Everybody, thanks for listening. Have a great week. And hit Mark up if you're curious about the wonderful science that he's involved.